Okay, welcome folks, Elvin Shamroth here. This is our second teleconference of the year, and I'll tell you at the outset, I'm very, very, very surprised this has never happened before. We've got only one or two people that have signed in. Usually we have, at the beginning of the year, 20, 30 people. And then it goes up to 60, 100, 150 sometimes. So I'm just shocked that there's virtually no one attending. And I'm wondering whether, in fact, the email went out. So I apologize if it didn't go out. I've no reason to believe that it didn't, but based on the numbers, it looks odd. Anyway, given the fact that this is a very, very, very small audience, what I'm going to do, I have not muted anyone out, and there's one or two comments that I can make of relevance, which I'll do at the end. But before I do that, I would like to... Since no one volunteered to be on the hot seat, so to speak, no one submitted any questions or concerns or cases on their cases that they weren't sure how to present them, since no one did that, I'm going to just open it up to the handful of people who are listening in and ask you, as we did last time, just shout out your first name. I'll acknowledge it, and then we can have a conversation. And again, just mention your first name. No need to mention your last name. We do want to keep you folks anonymous, because if you've got a complication or something, I'll ask you a question which might be embarrassing to answer. We do want you to remain anonymous. So only the first name, please. I'm going to throw it out. If you have a question, please shout out your first name. And I don't hear anything, folks. I know we're 7 months into cases collection. I know you folks have questions. I know you have concerns, and you're just a little shy to shout out. So again, I'm going to ask you folks, if you have a question or a concern, just shout out your first name and I'll acknowledge and we can talk. So it's open to you folks. Someone wants to shout out their name, please. Folks, if no one wants to volunteer, this is going to be a very, very short teleseminar. So I urge you, please, even a simple question, just shout out your name and let's have a conversation. So I throw it open to you folks. Come on, folks. Someone.
Hi there. My name is Julia.
Julia, thank you so, so much for volunteering. I appreciate it. Go ahead. What's your question? What's your concern?
So I guess one of my questions are, I know that there's a depth of knowledge that the examiners continue to push you, and there's several levels of questions, and as they continue to ask you questions, the difficulty level obviously increases. My question for you is, when you get to the point where you don't know the material or the information, what is the appropriate way to state that? Do you say, you know, that's something you need to look up? Is that something you'd say, I'd have access to resources and I would look that up? Or what would be the best answer when you get to that point?
So I really appreciate this, Julia, because it's a very good question, and a question that everyone is thinking about. So thank you for standing up and being the brave one. There are a lot of ways to handle this. The short answer is just to say, I don't know. That's my short response to you. But I need to give you a lot more background so you have a better understanding of what's going on. From a hypothetical point of view, you're going to face a few hundred questions during the 3 hours of your exam. And in each of those questions, so some of the questions are going to be what I call pass and fail questions. If you don't know if they ask you, what's the treatment of preeclampsia with severe features, and you say, I don't know, which is not your question. Your question was, as it gets harder and harder. It's not your question, but I'm just giving you the broader answer. So if you say, I don't know, to what I term hypothetically a pass-fail question, you can understand, obviously, the examiner's not going to be impressive. And you won't fail off one wrong answer or one I don't know. But if you don't know the answer to a basic question like that, you leave the examiner with the idea in his or her mind, how the hell can I pass this patient, this candidate, if he or she doesn't know how to treat preeclampsia? And none of you would argue with that. So that's a pass-fail question. Don't get a pass-fail question wrong. Now, there are other questions. Julia, if I ask you, what's the difference between omphalocele and gastroschisis? Would you be able to answer that question? You don't have to give the answer, but would you be comfortable to answer that question?
I could definitely give you some differences. Like, I know one has a...
Okay, and I would expect you to be able to give some reasonable response to that. But
sure.
And that's what the examiner would expect, okay? Now, if you didn't know the answer to that question, okay, are you seen in the same light as the scenario where you didn't know the treatment of preeclampsia? The question is clearly no. You're not on your way to fail like you would have been with the preeclampsia question, but you've left the examiner disappointed, but you've got however much time left in the exam to recover, and that one question will be moderated in all likelihood upwards based on the balance of the questions that you've been asked and your responses. So, yeah, you take a minor back step, but it's not a big deal. The opportunity to recover is fine. Now, let's take the third type of question, which is more in keeping with your kind of question that you ask. Let's say you, which is probably the single most commonly asked series of questions in the exam, is the management of postpartum hemorrhage. This might even be the example that you had in mind, Julia. You know, all of us can treat preeclampsia, postpartum hemorrhage. But what happens if you get to a situation and they start asking you about a bilateral hypergastric artery ligation, and what's the anatomy of the hypergastric artery, or the common iliac, the anterior and posterior divisions? Now, some of us would be able to answer that with a bit of difficulty. Most of us probably wouldn't be able to. But if they were to ask you even more extreme, describe for me how you would do a hypergastric artery ligation. It's almost a trick question, because if you start describing how you might attempt it, that is going to leave them with, again, the feeling that you're dangerous and they're going to be disinclined to pass you. So, you know, an extreme situation, it's totally okay to say, A, I don't know. You might say in a non-emergency situation, I don't know, I would look that up. I'm very specific about a non-emergency situation, because any emergency, no matter how esoteric it might be, you've got to be able to address it, because any emergency can come up tomorrow. Now, in PPH, you might say back to me, but hypergastric ligation, this is a PPH, this is an emergency. No, it's not. If the way to respond to this actual question, you've got a patient who's bleeding out and that's an emergency. You don't have to do a PPH. you would go straight to a hysterectomy. And if your response might be to the examiner, if I had the knowledge to do a hypogastric artery ligation, I would do it. But in my hands, if I were to attempt that procedure, it would be more dangerous than helpful to the patient. And so I would proceed to a hysterectomy. I would be more concerned with saving the patient's life than saving her uterus. So, you know, I inadvertently muted the phone there for a second. You don't have to always give an answer to the question directly answering the question. It's okay to say, I don't know, or I wouldn't do this for this reason, or I would do something else. The most important thing is they know that when you're getting to the situation where they're starting to ask you about hypogastric artery ligation, you're well down the road. You've covered 95% of PPH, and you're in good shape. There's no way they're going to count you down when you don't know the answer to an extreme situation. Another example that I can think of would be shoulder dystocia. Every single one of you has to be absolutely perfect on PPH and shoulder dystocia. These are real emergencies that have to be practiced. We've got to be very comfortable with them. And if they, towards the, you know, 5 minutes into the conversation, start asking you about would you consider a symphysiotomy and how do you do a symphysiotomy, one or two of you might be asked that question in the exam. It's rare. And if you know the answer, you impress your examiner immensely. But to your question, Julia, if you don't know the answer, you lose nothing. You lose absolutely nothing because they don't really expect you to know the answer. They're just pushing you to see how far you can go. So, Julia, I gave a bit of a long-winded answer. Did I answer your question, though?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I didn't realize that you could, you know, not directly answer the question. Like if you say something like, I have never performed a symphysiotomy, I don't feel comfortable performing that, I would be capable of an emergency infection or something that would divert away from that.
Yeah. Look, and this raises a much bigger issue. At the end of the day, whatever you say, make sure that you leave them with the unambiguous understanding that whatever you're going to do, you're going to be safe. You're not cavalier. You're not going to take chances. You're not going to put the patient at any excessive or undue risk. And you'll be fine if you do that. So, what was the Julia? I'm assuming you've got a particular complication on your case list already that you're worried about it. What is that clinical scenario, if I may ask?
Actually, I had a GYN complication. There was she was in her 30s. She's a G0. She came in complaining of pelvic pain as a new patient. We did a transvaginal ultrasound, and I found a 5-centimeter dermoid cyst. She also has clinical diagnosis of endometriosis from a previous OBGYN that was pathology confirmed.
Did you say endometriosis? Is that what you said from the previous gynecologist?
Yeah.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
Yep, pathologically diagnosed endometriosis from a prior gynecologist. She also had a prior history of an 8-centimeter dermoid cyst that prior gynecologist had removed. Came to me as a new patient with chronic pelvic pain, and on my scan, I found a 5-centimeter dermoid cyst on the contralateral side from the previous dermoid excision. And so I took her back for a diagnostic laparoscopy. I found some adhesions. I lysed those adhesions. I looked at her dermoid. I attempted to remove it laparoscopically, however, was unable to because of the density of the cyst. I could not remove it out of the posterior cul-de-sac. So I made a mini laparotomy and was able to remove it through an open fashion. The complication is I saw her 2 weeks post-op, and she was doing fine, still some continued pain. The patient had not been taking her pain medication as prescribed for fear of constipation, but I she wasn't even taking her Tylenol or ibuprofen, so I told her to start that.
Mm-hmm.
A month later, without calling the office, she shows up to the emergency room with continued pelvic and abdominal pain, and a CT scan showed a 10-centimeter fluid collection in the pelvis, which they were unable to differentiate between an abscess or a hematoma. The patient has extreme vaginismus and was not going to do another transvaginal ultrasound. So I ordered an MRI, which showed a 12.8 collection in the pelvis, again, unable to differentiate if it was an abscess or a hematoma. And I had interventional radiology drain it, and they drained 110 cc's mm-hmm. of old dark red blood. I don't have an explanation mm-hmm. for why that happened.
Okay, look, let me just share. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I don't have an explanation for why that happened, but it was hemostatic when I left, so I don't know.
Okay. So I'm pleased you brought this question up. Two comments. Number one, we're jumping the gun because you were a little long-winded in presenting the case. All of you need to practice being able to succinctly present your case, because then in the exam, every second is precious, and they're not going to give you, Julian, the amount of time that I gave you to get the point across. So I want you and everyone listening in just to be aware of this and practice getting your presentations across very succinctly. And again, we'll discuss this kind of thing, oral exam technique, in greater detail after August the 1st, after caseless submission deadline. But right now, it's not too critical. But that's the first point. The second point, it is. Let me put it to all of you listening. There is always a case that you've had, or you're certainly going to have, that your examiner has had, where they can't explain what happened. The pathology was a surprise finding. There was a complication which was a surprise finding. I'm sure amongst those of you who are listening in, you've had or have heard of a colleague who labored a patient as a vertex and delivered her as a vaginal breech. These kind, I mean, they're not common, but they happen. Sometimes, as in your case, Julia, there's just, you don't know how it occurred. And it's okay to say that. One of the points I want to, and you'll hear me emphasizing this throughout the year, I want to drive home, always be open, be honest, and be sincere. Because when you do that, you subconsciously give the examiner the understanding that you've got integrity. You're not hiding. It's not a game. You're being open and honest and sincere with them. And it shows that you're genuine and that you've got integrity. And that's a very good character trait that they want to be comforted with that you're showing. So it's okay to say, you know, I'll just role-play your situation, Julia. This was a patient who had a teratoma removed from the cul-de-sac, having had previous diagnosis of histology and confirmed endometriosis, went in a fair amount of adhesions. I was able to get the teratoma out, and when I was done, I was very comfortable that the pelvis was dry. It was to my surprise that she subsequently presented 2 weeks later with a hematoma. I've got to be honest, you say this in the exam, I've got to be honest, I don't know, I've looked at this case backwards many, many times, discussed it with QA, discussed it with colleagues, I can't account for the reason why that mass, the hematoma reaccumulated, but it did, and I was forced to deal with it. So I can't tell you why it happened, I don't think I'll ever know. I'm guessing it was X, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure. it's quite okay to say that. You follow what I'm saying, Julia?
Yes.
So, and I think you will agree with me that that kind of approach shows you off to be totally honest, open, honest, and sincere, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm also going to assume, which is what I get with every candidate when I go through this, what they say is, and I'm going to throw it open to you, Julia, would you be comfortable to give this kind of a response in the exam?
Yes, I would, because I did discuss it with my senior partner and other colleagues.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I called my senior partner immediately once I got the read.
Yeah,
the call.
Because this is what we do. We're all making sound, appropriate decisions. You just need to be comfortable to share it with the examiner. And the fact that you got a surprise finding, and any of you listening in who have not had a surprise finding, it's going to happen, and it's going to be on the case list. And that's okay. Just be totally comfortable to be open and honest about it. So, Julia, are you okay with that issue then? Or is there still something else that you want to discuss?
No, that was very helpful. Thank you so much.
Sure. No problem. All right. Very good. I'm going to throw it open to anyone else. If you just want to shout out your name, I'll acknowledge and then we can have a conversation. So anyone else want to pose a question? Come on, folks, don't be shy. Oh, my goodness, you're a tough crowd. I've never had such a poor turnout and such a quiet audience as I have had this year. This year is going to be a tough, quiet, shy crowd. So, folks, come on, I want to have a conversation. I want to share thoughts with you. Please, someone shout out their first name and I'll acknowledge and we'll have a conversation. Come on, I open it up to you folks. It's up to you. Otherwise, there's nothing to talk about.
Hi, this is Jessica.
No one. Yes. Jessica, thank you so much for shouting out your name. I appreciate it. Go ahead, share with us your concern.
Yeah, so my case, I'm just trying to figure out how to compile them because I have a specific patient who ended up on my list after my partner saw her. So she was a 78-year-old, came in for postmenopausal bleeding, but she had multiple other comorbidities. She was on dialysis, and she wasn't primarily our patient. But initially, the bleeding got heavy what was decided to do was uterine artery embolization, which IR did.
Mm-hmm.
But 24 hours later, she still kept having heavy bleeding. And so I made the decision once it was my day on call to take her back for helped her bleeding. And the pathology came back as squamous cell carcinoma, likely of the cervix.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that was assaulted in gynonc.
Okay, so you feel embarrassed that you started off with a diagnosis of postmenopausal bleeding, missed mm-hmm. the cervical squamous cell carcinoma, which statistically mm-hmm. certainly it's very likely to be, and that was the final diagnosis. My question, this is a great case also, and it brings up an issue that all of you need to do for your cases, especially the complicated cases. And I hope all of you have complications. I think I mentioned this 2 weeks ago. It's wonderful in the exam to have complications, not in practice, but in the exam. And I hope you all do have complications. So if we have a complication here. At this point in time, when you're putting your cases together, this is the time when you need to be considering, how is this conversation going to go in the exam? And based on how you think it's going to go, what do I need to write down to assist me in what I'm planning on having to describe and having to say? So, Jessica, the question that I'm posing to you now is, what do you think, given the scenario, what do you think is the direction where this case is going to hinge upon to discuss to evaluate your management? What's the key issue in this case, would you say, if you were the examiner, that you wanted to, you'd want to drill down on? What would you say that is?
Looks like your management for postmenopausal bleeding. What are you? Or are there medications?
I'm going to be. You're on the right track. You're not wrong. But I'm going to be a little bit more specific. In your workup of a patient with postmenopausal bleeding, is it not reasonable to assume that you would have done a pelvic exam and a speculum exam as a part of considering or attempting to do an office biopsy? That's really where I'm honing in on. So was there any of that happening in her initial management?
Yeah, so she came into the office a week prior, and then she did get an office EMB, but it was insufficient. It was just more like scan, basically non-diagnostic.
Okay, but I'm so pleased we're bringing up this. You brought up this case, Jessica, because it's good for you and it's good for everyone listening in. You're working on the assumption based on the pathologist report, which is reasonable, although surprising. 80-year-olds don't typically get cervical cancer, just by the way, okay? Maybe it was squamous metaplasia of endometrium, but that's also not common, you know? But nevertheless, when you did your pelvic exam and speculum, did you not get an opportunity to visualize the cervix?
Yeah. When at the time.
And how did it? Say again. Sorry, I missed that.
Oh, when I took her to the operating room, because I didn't see her as an outpatient, nor was the.
Okay, so when you took her to the, so you saw her in the OR for the first time. Is that what you're saying? The preoperative workup was done by a colleague.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. So did the colleague? See, at this point, you've got no reason to suspect that the colleague missed something visually.
Right.
Okay? So you're assuming it's all normal, you didn't comment on it, and you're assuming you're dealing with a case of postmenopausal bleeding. But now you're in the OR, and you're managing this patient. What did the cervix look like?
It looked pretty normal to me.
Okay, so look, I'm very happy for you that it was normal, because it makes your defense so much easier. But this is such a good question, such a good case, Jessica. You know, this is rich and it's so important. You did not realize what I was driving at, because if you did not mention to me in your initial presentation, let's say I'm being the examiner, you did not mention that the cervix appeared normal. And this whole case revolves around that issue. Was the cervix macroscopically normal? Would you agree with me that that's a key, critical piece of information? And feel free to disagree with me, by the way. Jessica and everyone listening in, I'm a generalist. I'm not claiming to know everything. You should feel totally comfortable to disagree with me if you feel I'm saying something incorrectly. Jessica, do you think the crux of this case with respect to its defense revolves around the macroscopic appearance of the cervix to determine whether this patient was mismanaged or not? Your thoughts, Jessica?
Right. Yeah. No, I think mentioning that it appeared normal. I don't think anyone would have been at fault to miss that.
Okay. Fine. But the criticism that, and it's a minor one, the criticism that I'm presenting to you is that you did not mention that to me. That was a bit of important information that should have come out spontaneously in your presentation. What I'm trying to share with you folks is you need to try and work out, and you can do it in the vast majority of cases. It's not hard. But as you, and especially with complications, as you stand back and look at the case from 35,000 feet, ask yourself, what is the key issue here? What will be important for me to say in the exam? Spontaneously as opposed to having the examiner drag it out of me. And in this situation, I would present this case along the following lines, see if you like it or not. And feel free to disagree with me, Jessica. I would say this was an 8-year-old woman who was initially seen by my partner who did a she presented with a postmenopausal bleeding and did an endometrial biopsy, which came back inadequate. He, after counseling, set her up for a DNC, and he went on vacation, she went on vacation, and I landed up doing the case. Now, before the case, I did what I normally do. I did a pelvic exam. The cervix felt absolutely smooth and normal as an EUA. And then once the patient was asleep, I put in a speculum, and again, I've got to tell you, the cervix looked totally normal. So I was very surprised when the histology subsequently came back showing that she had a squamous cell carcinoma, which I thought would have been of the uterus, which is in endometrium, which is not common at all. One has to have squamous metaplasia of glandular tissue before you can get a squamous cell carcinoma on that squamous metaplasia. But the pathologist said he suspected this was coming from the cervix. And so, you know, my pre- and post-op diagnoses were rather different. I've looked at this case subsequently from many, many different angles. And I've got to be honest, if I was to manage this patient again, I think I would do exactly the same thing. It was just an unfortunate situation that she, we assume, had a cervical cancer, but that it was perhaps high up in the canal, and there was no indication to suspect that it was coming from the cervix. The only question you've got to be able to discuss in addition to that is, was a pap smear warranted? Because, you know, by the time the average woman is 8 years old, we're not doing pap smears on them anymore. So right. That's something that you need to be able to speak to. But just by the way, pap smear protocols are more an office discussion rather than a GYN discussion. But there's a small chance that for one or two questions you can go down that road. But, Jessica, the way I've presented this to you, does that sound a reasonable way to present it?
Yeah.
Feel free to disagree.
No, I think so. I mean, that hits all the points that happened. I mean, she was seen by my partner in her office notes, the cervix appeared normal. She did the office ENB.
Yeah. So this is the... Yeah, you say in the exam, it'll become clear in a moment why I'm saying this, but in his notes, the cervix appeared totally normal. When I examined her, if you do an EUA before every case, it felt totally normal, and in the OR, it looked totally normal. So I was surprised when, and then you carry on. So again, you notice the common theme between my response to your question, Jessica, and Julia's question, the common theme is be open and be honest and be yourself, be sincere, be transparent. You come across the best way when you do just that. So does that make sense to you, Jessica?
Yes, thank you.
All right, sure. All right, if there's anyone more, we've got time for one more question. If anyone wants to shout out their first name, I'll be happy to acknowledge. Anyone? Come on, don't be shy. First name. No one? I'll give you another shot at it. going once, going twice. Come on, I'm waiting out for a first name. Going twice, going three times, no takers. All right, I'm not going to force you folks, but I do want to encourage you, you know, to volunteer and submit cases to the office via email. You can leave your name anonymous. Just give your first name. It's easier for me to communicate with you if you just leave your first name. And we'll be happy to discuss that case with you. Folks, I do want to just bring to your attention something that's, you know, I always use this as an opportunity to share with you what's going on in the OBGYN world that might potentially be exam relevant. And on Friday, ABOG made available for the first time this year the MOC Part 3 articles. Now, I'm not going to go into much detail except to say ABOG gives anywhere from I think 12 to, depending, they've reduced the number. It used to be 15, for a total of 45 per year. I think they've reduced it to 24 because of Corona. It's probably going to go back very, very shortly. But the point that I want to make is your examiner, in order to maintain board certification, which is an absolute requirement for them to be an examiner, has to read these articles just as I do to maintain my board certification status. And as you all will start in January, February next year to maintain your certification status that you will receive at the end of this year, God willing. So the first list of, I think it's 12 or 13 articles, came out just last week, the end of last week. And they usually bring out three sets of articles, usually January. They were a little late this year. January, May, and August. That's usually when they release about 12 articles per session. I'm telling you straight out now, you know, just by the way, we know statistically that virtually every single one of you will attend our cases construction course and later on in the year come to our definitive board prep course. We just know that because we track our candidates as best as we can. I will discuss this with you folks in more detail later on in the year. But I just want to share with you that we will, after August, when the complete list has been published, we will give you a list of those articles, the titles. I'm not saying that you need to go and pull 45 or 36, however many articles. I'm not saying you have to go and pull all those articles. That would be overkill. But you need to go through the list of titles and see if any of those titles have any relevance or connection to any case that you might have on your cases, because the basis of that article may come up by the examiner, because they probably have read it and it's fresh in their mind. And even better still, if you can bring it up yourself, that's also even more impressive. So I just want you to know that these MSC articles have been issued for the first batch this year. We will give you the list later on in the year when you come to our definitive board prep course. So, we've got you covered. But I want you to be aware that don't go and pull the articles and read the article, all the articles. If, for example, you've got a case, I'll just give you an example because I've just started reading the first one. It's entitled Perioperative Outcomes in a Nationwide Sample of Patients Undergoing Surgical Treatment of Ovarian Endometriomas. So pretty much every one of you have got a case like that on your list. So it's not a bad idea to at least go through the titles. And if you've got a case relevant to that on your list, you may want to at least read at a minimum the abstract, and maybe you might want to read a little bit more. I'll get a little plug in. We do provide summaries for you folks if you're interested. It's an extra charge, but it's there if you want, but you don't have to get that. But I just want you to know that MOC articles are important because you folks, before you get into your exam room, you need to get yourselves in sync with what your examiner is reading. So one of the things they are reading is the MOC articles. And so I just wanted you to be aware of that. Alrighty, I think I've spoken too much. We're almost coming up on 45 minutes, which is roughly how long I like to keep this going. I will ask you folks, please, to volunteer and send us your cases before, in the week before the Sunday of the next teleseminar, which I think will be in 2 weeks' time. So today is, what's today, the 6th? The 5th. So it'll be the 19th, I guess, will be the next teleseminar. And please encourage your friends and colleagues to join. It's free, and free is good. And we'd be happy to, I'd be happy to have this conversation with you folks again in 2 weeks' time. So to Jessica and Julia, I appreciate that you volunteered with a little bit of coaxing. And I'm happy also that you found it was very, very helpful. So to all of you, thanks for joining, and we'll do this again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much. This then concludes our teleconference. Thank you. Bye-bye.